Hey everybody, JJ Cooper and Alex Speer today on another of the Baseball America Prospect Podcast Deep Dives. And if you follow the Boston Red Sox at all, I think that you're going to have a pretty good idea what's going on here, who we're going to talk about if you see Alex on the pod. I think we did this about this time last year, Alex. It's always good to talk to you. You're getting ready to head down to spring training, but before you do, we're going to talk Red Sox prospects. Coming off of a very interesting season where we saw Roman Anthony obviously emerge as a big leaguer and someone who looks like he's going to be a big league star. And then at the end of the year, Peyton Tolley comes up, who is number one in the system. Great to see you. How are you doing? And how has your offseason been as you get ready to ramp it up for another MLB season?
Yeah, well, it's the offseason is one that certainly keeps you busy. This has been an interesting one from the Red Sox perspective in that they're so trade heavy right now. They're so trade heavy right now. And so we both lived through this with the top 10 of the Red Sox system having to be reshuffled as they think about not only how to use that, use their top prospects in order to be able to reinforce the big league team, but also reshape different aspects of their minor league team. It's been a fascinating offseason for them in many respects. But I'm excited to see players on the field again. That's always, kind of the joy of the job, right?
It is. And you hit on that one thing before we kind of dive further in. I do kind of find interesting about this is part of that is by where this team is now, finally, is that, this is the team that went to the playoffs last year that is about contention now, not building for some future down the road. But on top of that, when you look at it, another reality of this is that there's, if everything goes the way the Red Sox want, there just aren't that many openings. There aren't that many spots where you're saying, okay, this prospect's going to step up. Some of the trades we saw, like seeing, the past where Josh Nixon Garcia being traded to the Pirates is in part where it's like, if you've got a guy who's at AAA, who's basically big league ready, and you look at it and say, well, I don't think he's going to make our roster, then it's probably smart to move a guy like that now rather than let him spend year two in AAA and maybe start to lose a little bit of that prospect value. Maybe you get some depth down the road, but they've been having moves like that, it seems like, in some cases.
Yeah, there's been a much more intentional approach to kind of leveling out areas of organizational surplus and in trying to address areas of organizational deficiency, or in this case, building a surplus in a different area, because what the Red Sox have been incredibly focused on since Craig Breslow came over as chief baseball officer was taking a farm system that was rich in position playing prospects, where that was the obvious strength of their organization, and trying to balance that out with enough starting pitching and enough high-end starting pitching, both established big leaguers and kind of young promising prospects, that they have the ability to withstand the proverbial attrition of the season. So to think about how drastically the organization has changed in terms of its strengths on a one-year, two-year, three-year basis is pretty striking.
Along those lines, I do find it kind of that really kind of started even, I guess, last year, we could say, because last year was the Garrett Crochet trade, when we were also remaking the top 10 and the top 30 over and over. Like, you had the Garrett Crochet trade last year. This year we've seen multiple moves, but that ties in to the number one prospect on the Red Sox system. Peyton Tolley, number one. Coming out of the 2025 season, it would have seemed logical that you to expect off the fine work he had, okay, this is someone who's going to be in their opening day rotation in 2026. Here we are, and barring injury, it looks like he's ticketed to head back to Worcester to start the year, is he not?
I think that that's an extremely high likelihood. And it's interesting because Tolley is someone who traveled kind of the same, like that same blitzing through the minors path that we saw in a Trey Savage, right? But with the difference being that Savage had multiple pitches that were really weapons in the strike zone. At the major league level, obviously success followed Trey Savage into that starting pitcher role in the big leagues. Whereas for Peyton Tolley, He dominated in a way that I don't think anyone expected across multiple levels of the minors. He just, you know, he was just kind of an avalanche going downhill over the course of the 2025 season, where it was like, oh, he's punching out a lot of people in high A and in double A and in a few triple A starts. And then that very impressive body of work did not translate at the big league level because he just didn't have feel for his secondaries once he got up there, right? Like, he had a wonderful major league debut in which he was able to overpower the Pirates lineup, largely on the strength of that high 90s heater with a lot of adrenaline behind it, that major league debut. And
the Pirates lineup. You hit a key one there also. The Pirates lineup, which will not compare with the Dodgers or the Yankees or several other teams as lineups that you're really worried about. How do you turn this over?
Or the Diamondbacks, against whom he made his second big league start, and they were just sitting fastball, and he wasn't able to execute anything else in the zone. Even though, you know, I'm not sure if you got to see him, JJ. I think you did at some point over the course of the 2025 season. I got a great look at him in AAA right in his last start before he got called up, and he was executing the whole shebang, right? Like, he looked really impressive in a way that he was carving up the strike zone against, I think, a pretty advanced AAA team in Buffalo, with, you know, he was landing his slider and he was landing a sweeper and he was executing a changeup just below the bottom of the zone. And the AAA lineup looked overmatched against the full arsenal, but he didn't have feel for it once he got to the big leagues. And so right now, Peyton Tully is trying to show that he's going to be in a position, he has to establish himself in AAA. The Red Sox have an opportunity to let him reestablish himself in AAA. This is the whole arsenal. It's not just going to be fastball only. And if he's that guy, if he is able to land a lot of different stuff, a lot of different weapons in the strike zone, then you're looking at a mid-rotation starter. But they don't need to rush that equation and have him, you know, and have him get his brains beaten out if he's only a one-pitch pitcher at the beginning of 2026.
Tito to me is one of the guys I'm most interested to see. When we get to spring training, I mean, there's parts of spring training that are noise and there's parts of it that are signal. And when you're talking to Peyton Tully, and I'm reading those stories not long from now, and he's talking about what he did over the offseason to work on his secondaries and things like that, that's going to be fun to watch in March to see kind of how he's developing that way. It does kind of strike me, him and Connelly Early, who also was a guy who kind of rocketed up last year, pair of guys who now seem to have a little bit more time to develop because, again, the depth of this rotation now was totally like the slam dunk, like, okay, this is obviously number one. Or was there any like, okay, maybe it's Franklin Arias again, or, you know, Kyson Witherspoon was our first round pick. Connelly Early had a very good year. This is very starterish, although not with the same quality of fastball. Was totally the clear number one to you as you kind of did your reporting?
There was some conversation about Tully versus Arias. I think that Arias had his backers, but ultimately, I thought that the industry value seemed to be pretty clear. There was a pretty strong consensus around the game about Tully carrying more value right now. Arias being someone who's further off, he's someone who, as a teenager, so super impressive, super fast track in his own right, reached double A last at the end of last year. And you're still waiting to see some tools develop in a way like there's, you know, whereas Tully at least flashed everything, right? Like, he flashed everything that you would need for a mid-rotation starter. Arias is still if he develops another half grade to a grade of power, then you're talking about someone whose profile would really put him as a slam dunk to be, you know, an above average everyday shortstop as opposed to an average everyday shortstop. He's a guy with a great floor considering that he was only 19 mm-hmm. in double A last year, because the defense is so good, because the bat to ball is so good. But you're waiting for that clear view of impact to crystallize, whereas with Tully, it was there. And so there was conversation, but I think ultimately there was a clear lean, a strong lean in the conversation. I'll say it was clearer for Tully over Arias than it was a year ago with Roman Anthony versus Christian Campbell, for instance, which is wild to think about.
It is wild now, but at the time, yeah. I mean, it was Christian Campbell had such a season in 24. With Arias, the thing I do find fascinating there is I think 10, 15 years ago, Franklin Harris would not be appreciated the same way. And the reason I say that is that he doesn't run all that well. And it used to be that kind of there was an adage that if you're a, you know, especially his age, if you can't, you know, if you don't have that plus speed or above average speed, oh, okay, well then are you going to have the range to be a shortstop? I feel like over the last decade, we've seen like these bigger shortstop. The Corey Seager didn't run all that well. There's a number of shortstops who have not run all that well and been quite good at shortstop. Arias, like you said, it's not the physical, he's not the physical monster. It's more of kind of that the skills are so advanced at a very young age, isn't it? Like it's something where for a teenager, the bat to ball skills, the understanding of how to do everything defensively and then execute it. It's kind of those skill components of it are so advanced and the tools are solid, as opposed to we've seen a lot of guys over the years where it's like, okay, the 19-year-old who the tools are amazing. And it's like, well, but we got to see, can he learn how to hit? You know, which pitches to hit, make contact. Can he tone all these things down? Arias kind of is really advanced in some of those aspects, isn't he?
Yeah, he's game feel over like explosiveness, right? And so, you know, it's interesting at any given point in time how much those two things are valued. And we've become, like, the industry has become better at quantifying the game feel part of things, right, in terms of being able to measure out conversion and being able to quantify reaction time and, you know, and how that plays into range and that sort of thing, in order to appreciate someone who, despite, as you rightly point out, this is someone who already is, you know, he is not even a 50 runner. He's a 20-year-old who is a, you know, who's like, you know, maybe scraping 45 as a runner right now, and it's probably going to tick down. But just does such a good job of having feel for the game that that his defense plays well above that, and the industry has progressed to the point where there's an opportunity to believe in that as a kind of sticky skill set, rather than thinking like, oh, he managed to get to some balls but he's not fast enough to keep doing that. Well, we now are able to view things differently, and I just think that you learn so much watching players in games. This is what, you know, why it's still great to have scouts. Like, clock is so, like, is such a powerful thing. And it is so, particularly for an infielder, like, just that internal instinctive clock for, you know, to be moving slight, to have a lean at the point of contact, right? And to know where the ball is going to be going based on understanding pitch types and pitch locations and all of that stuff, and picking up, you know, picking up like swing paths and the whole shebang. You know, it really is striking to see the defenders who excel at just being able to read the game and what's in front of them. You know, and it's interesting too, because like Arias is probably viewed as a better defensive shortstop prospect than Marcelo Meyer. And Marcelo Meyer's gifts are also that just wonderful, wonderful game clock, the ability to anticipate, the ability to remain calm and have wonderful quick reaction times in those kind of magic hands that are able to be, you know, to serve the role of prestidigitator when it comes to those infield smashes, which is why he looked so natural at third base last year, because he's just able to, you know, to just, you know, do the kind of Mr. Miyagi thing with his glove. And it's super fun to watch.
Okay. I will just start by saying the Red Sox system is clearly, as a farm system, worse than it was last year. That's no knock. Roman Anthony was our top prospect in the game at this time last year. Christian Campbell was a top 10 prospect as well. You graduate those, you're not going to be at the same level. It's still a system with multiple top 100 prospects, but I will even phrase this a little different. Instead of saying, is this worse, better, or worse than last year, how much has it changed? How much has it taken a hit? Not just for graduations, but like you said, there's kind of been a rebalancing of this farm system as well, has there not?
I don't know that I've, you know, JJ, you guys have had me doing the top 10 list for, I think this was my 14th season of it. And I don't know that I've ever seen a more massive year over year alteration to the Red Sox farm system than I have from 25 into 26, because not only was it those three guys knocking on the door in the form of Anthony, Campbell, Meyer, right? Like, you know, Marcelo, there was a, like, Marcelo by the end of spring training last year, like, was, had reestablished himself as kind of spectacular prospect credentials, just was so good when he was kind of in the rhythm of the game and healthy, and just the talent was great. Yeah. So not only do you have, did you have this group of almost major league ready guys who were knocking on the door, who were elite across the game, but they were all position players, right? And now we've gone to a, now we've gone to a Red Sox farm system where at the top, aside from Arias, you have a bunch of pitchers. And then beneath that, you have, and then when it comes to the position players, they are all far from the big leagues. Like, there's a chance for Arias, because of the glove, to make a, an impact at the big league level at the, by the end of 2026, depending on the health of the Red Sox and how some different things develop. But otherwise, you know, their position players are, you know, coming out of the DSL or coming out of A ball. And it is just a wildly different system now than it was a year ago. And it's, yeah, the change is monumental, right? They don't have those guys. They have pitchers who are going to be able to contribute in the near term. And that, that has been such a clear emphasis for this organization over the course of the last, again, dating back to when Craig Breslow was hired. Like, one of the first things that he did was to acquire a guy like Richard Fitz as a piece in the Alex Verdugo trade to the Yankees. And, you know, Fitz ended up being major league depth. And we've just seen, you know, we've seen the Red Sox since then just continue to work on reshaping their major league depth, their major league pitching depth as it extends into AAA. And it is a wildly different system. Although, JJ, it is also interesting to think about, like, Marcelo Meyer lost his prospect eligibility by a few at bats. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it would be off. Marcelo would have been the number one prospect for me had he remained eligible this year. Mm-hmm. And I would also be curious, you know, if you were to think about how close, you know, where he would fall in the top 100,
he'd still be quite high. I think this way to summarize it, how much it changed, looking at last year's top 10 at the prospect handbook, top Red Sox top 10. So the top three graduated that we just talked about, the big three. And then another four from that top 10 have been traded since then. So there are three players, and we just talked about, you know, Arias, who was in there, and we talked about Connelly Early, who was in there, who was number 10. Yoelin Cespedes, who's in the top 30, is the only other member of the top 10 from a year ago who's still eligible to rank on this list. And by the way, you just mentioned, like, you know, it's not just that, like, Hunter Dobbins was number 11. He's been traded. And yeah, Richard Fitz was number 12. And he's been, so it's the top of this system. There's been, from last year, there's been graduations, but there's also been a ton of trades, which does make sense. Again, when we talk about this from the standpoint of when you have these guys who are big league ready and their depth, but it's also like 40 man roster construction and some other pieces like that, that kind of all tie into this. That also means, as we look ahead to next year, I don't expect there to be the same amount of changeover as there was at this time this year. Like, when you look at this top 10, I think there's a number of guys who could still be back again next year, but mm-hmm. we would expect that Tolley's going to graduate. I would say that Connelly right. Early should be expected to graduate. Outside of that, Jake Bennett, who they traded for, but, you know, I could see him graduating as well, conceivably, but who kind of fits in that next year? Maybe not, maybe not, but who fits in that group for next year? Like, could be the number one. Again, we're going to have graduations. There probably will be some moves. Is Arias the logical one, considering his age and the fact that he's probably not going to make his major league debut in 2026?
Or even if he makes his major league debut, there's a high likelihood that he retains prospect eligibility at the end of, I mean, if he's making his major league debut, it's probably just amplifying his case as number one by the end of this year, because it would most likely be kind of the September scenario where he's getting his shot. So, yeah, I think that Arias is the clear candidate to be number one. That's why he's ranked number two. But I do think that there's also a group. Kyson Witherspoon is another obvious candidate
from 25.
Right. And viewed as the best college right-hander in the 2025 draft. Someone who might end up starting the year in Double A. And, you know, there's I don't think the Red Sox are shy about the positive. It's now evident the Red Sox are among the many organizations that aren't shy about moving players quickly through that first professional season. So it's not outlandish to think that he could be in the same realm as the kind of like Toley like prospects who shoots through the minors and ends up emerging as a number one. So those would be the two most obvious, and that's why they're ranked where they are, right? Like if we assume that Toley and Early end up kind of aging out of prospect status, then prospects number two and four in a system are obvious candidates to emerge. There are a couple that are a little further down that have a chance to really make more considerable jumps, right? That would maybe not be necessarily within the realm of expectation. But I think that the candidates that you would point to there include Juan Valera, who was super impressive last year as a teenager, in many respects, super impressive. The ERA looked bad last year, right? Like, but we all get it. ERA is not really the predictive thing that we look for when evaluating prospects at this point. And he was someone who pounded the strike zone as a teenage starting pitcher. He's physically huge, but has enough body control to be able to land strikes while throwing, you know, while topping out like 98, 99 hundo. And, you know, and with the components of two pretty good secondary pitches. So he's someone who could make some considerable strides, particularly again, given the strike throwing, like he'll assert himself with a pretty good floor. And if he's getting to the upper levels by the end of the year as a very young pitcher, he might stand out. Justin Gonzalez has been and will be a fascinating lottery ticket / wild card. He is someone who just had enormous tools and no real game and very little game feel when the Red Sox signed him for very little money out of the Dominican a few years ago. And he's been fascinating because he hits the ball incredibly hard. He makes really good swing decisions, and he just happens to hit the ball into the ground. And so this is one of those strengths of the Red Sox system. The thing that unlocked Christian Campbell was taking a guy whose approach had been ground ball and line drive heavy and teaching him how to be able to kind of catch the ball, like, you know, change the contact point a little bit, get the ball in the air and be able to drive it from gap to gap. Gonzalez has huge power potential to the point where, you know, if he's not catching the ball quite as deep, but still has strong enough swing decisions that you accept some swing and miss, while selling out and taking some chances, he could emerge as a pretty fascinating prospect, particularly if he's able to continue to assert himself as a corner outfielder and not just a first base only profile. So that's someone who there's the possibility of huge offensive numbers from him. If a few different things click, it's not as high a probability as the other guys.
It's unlikely, but it could.
Yeah. That's the one where the tools are huge and there's an approach underlying it, but there would need to be some transformation to the game and to the offensive approach to allow it to unlock.
You just touched on this. One of the things that the Red Sox obviously have done a good job of is their hitting development kind of seemed like it took some strides. Is that still, like, if you were going to say, what are the Red Sox going to hang their hat on as a farm system? Is it that, or is it kind of solid development? Again, we saw the developments of a Toley, of a Connolly early, of some of these pitchers. Is it becoming a little bit more of a pitcher focused development? Again, obviously the answer is you want to do all of the above. You want to improve hitting, you want to improve defense, you want to improve pitching, but what do you think that they're good at developing?
Yeah, I think that the so-called low-hanging, like, they've done a great job of implementing processes that have allowed them to add power to their players across the board, both position players and pitchers. So, you know, bat speed training, they were behind Jason Ochard, a former driveline instructor who had a few years as the Phillies hitting coordinator and then was hired to oversee Red Sox hitting development. They've made major across the board gains in terms of bat speed training and getting guys to be able to hit the ball harder. And then they've been able to make huge gains in terms of implementing velocity programs across the organization. And so you see the Peyton Tolleys of the world kind of disappearing after they're drafted and emerging 8 months later, throwing 5 miles an hour harder. And that's Peyton Tolley isn't the only one for whom that's happening. So they've been able to attack those areas. And then subordinate to that, they've also, like, it's not like they've said, okay, that's enough. Like, just add power. They've done a really nice job of being thoughtful and intentional about creating systems that develop tools, right? And so I mentioned Batpath earlier with regards to Christian Campbell and Justin Gonzalez. That's something where they've had a really, like, they've done a really good job of coaching players up on figuring out, like, you know, how to get to good attack angles with their swings. And Franklin Arias is actually an interesting example of that, because he had been too steep as an 18-year-old, and they were like, well, this isn't really going to, you know, you're gonna hit a lot of pop-ups if you continue this way. And so he had he ended up with a super flat bat path last year, which explained how he got to this, like, to these incredible contact numbers, like just no zone swing and miss at all. And so now it's kind of continue to adjust the dials and find something where you're okay getting on that plane with the pitch to be able to drive it into the gaps a little bit more, or maybe clear the fences a little bit more with, and then if you add a little bit of strength, you're getting some homers out of it. They've been very good about coaching all of these elements. I do think that they have gotten to a point of balanced, you know, of having both position player and pitcher development programs that have been effective in building out tools. And now, you know, there is a game feel element to it that a lot of what they do is in these training sessions and training settings. And so if there is a critique of the Red Sox system that you hear most, it is whether or not all of the tools development is translating into games, and particularly on the defensive side of things. But I think that they've heard the criticism, and, you know, they recognize a need to tweak some of their programming and some of their training to get players to have better game feel as well.
Well, that's kind of a big picture look at the Red Sox farm system. For the video portion on YouTube, that's the end of this show. But at the same time, if you are listening on the podcast, or if you want to listen on the podcast, we're going to go on for a little while longer, talk about some of the sleepers in the organization and a little bit kind of the 2026 outlook right after this quick break. So, Alex, okay, looking past the top 10, we always have, as we're writing these up, there's always guys that you start, like, I write up guys and I'm like, man, I'm starting to really kind of be enamored by this guy. Sometimes it's talking to a scout about him. Sometimes it's watching some video. It can be different ways, but I'm guessing that there's a couple that pop to you that you're like, oh, that, you know, this is a guy to kind of keep an eye on going forward. Who kind of jumps out to you?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, there are a couple of players who kind of light you up with regards to their considerable potential. And I think that a couple of them are going to be coming out of the DSL this season and making their stateside debuts in shortstop Hector Ramos, as well as outfielder Harold Rivas. Those are guys who have really broad tool sets and kind of offer a number of opportunities to be able to contribute. You know, like, those are it shouldn't come as a huge surprise that, you know, that the guys who are viewed as having the ability to just fly up the rankings are going to be coming out of the DSL, because you know that when once you get stateside, particularly since, you know, you come stateside and the expectation is no longer that you spend a full season in short season, like the entire year in extended and then short season ball, but that they're going to be getting exposure to A ball by the end of it. You learn a lot about players, and if they continue their physical maturation, if they're able to start showing the ability to drive the ball to the gaps in games on top of interesting defensive floors and speed, then all of a sudden you start thinking like, oh, those are the guys who, you know, those are the guys who have a chance to be the kind of five tool talents. And then someone else who's not too far out of the top 10, but who's going to be interesting to, to monitor was Anthony Ionson, who was their third rounder out of LSU. Some people viewed him as being a much higher, as being a kind of, you know, someone who should have been taken higher than where he actually went. He was incredibly effective as the number two starter in a national championship caliber rotation. And he's someone who's probably going to end up, I'm interested to see him in spring training, see how much power he's added to the fastball, because it was already a kind of invisible fastball, certainly an invisible slider. And, you know, if you're adding power to deception, then you have with a guy who's more willing than most to throw strikes, you have a chance to move pretty quickly.
I don't want to put him on the Peyton Tolley track. That's unfair for him. But if he makes the developments like a Connelly early has, where, and it doesn't have to be that he shows up to spring training and you're like, oh, he's found 4 miles an hour. But if it's just even something where there's just this steady improvement where it's like, okay, he adds a mile an hour a year over the next couple, 3 years, I watch out to me for him, because as you said, like, that's kind of the only big question is, okay, you would like to see a little bit more velocity, a little bit more power behind it. Although, as you said, the fastball plays as is right now. They had on a LSU team that had a pair of aces. He was an ace. And you kind of saw that last year. He is one that really does jump out to me. I did want to ask a couple, because we're going to get the questions. The other thing that always happens is, some players, you know, the development's never linear, but some players rise up, some other players slide down. When you look at Miguel Blais, Mikey Romero, Cespedes, we talked about a little bit earlier, or an Alan Castro, those are guys who've ranked pretty high and then have slid down a little bit. Is there one of those that jumps out as the kind of the most likely to kind of really keep an eye on in 26? Or is there, you know, is it a kind of a more of a muddled group?
I think it is fairly muddled. I would say Mikey Romero is going to open the year in AAA, and he's going to be in big league camp, and he is beloved by established big leaguers. You know, he lights up the guys like Trevor Story. And I think there's something to that blink test, right? When you are a player who naturally gets buy-in from established big leaguers, I think that there's something there. And I think that Mikey Romero is someone who grew up he has really good game feel. Like I think that he has feel for his skill set in being able to figure out how to maximize it. So like he was someone who impressed me when I would see him, even though his numbers in AAA weren't great. But I frequently saw him being able to, even with relatively modest exit velocities, drive the ball into the gaps for extra base hits, because he just hits the ball at ideal launch angles when he makes contact. And, you know, the approach wasn't great. But I think that he just finds a way to, he's going to find a way to make himself into being a contributor. I don't know yet with guys like Miguel Blais, with guys like Yoelín Cespedes, there's still an opportunity for them to really figure things out. But I haven't seen enough of them being able to do so. I think that they've been focused on like on applying training stuff, and that it's taken away from their game feel. Like Miguel Blais is one of the great examples of that, because he just hits a ton of pop-ups and his pull rate has gone just bananas. And like, he's strong enough where, you know what, like he can dial it back a little bit. He can catch the ball a little bit deeper and still drive it to right center. And he hasn't been able to make that adjustment yet in terms of his approach. And so, you know, and so like there's the tools to still be an impact player. But the fact that someone with his prominent prospect profile of the last couple of years didn't get taken in the Rule 5 draft is awfully telling about where the gap is right now between tools and production.
The other thing that you talked a little bit earlier, there's been a shift here. We've seen prospects now get moved to help the big league club. We've seen that in multiple cases. We've now seen prospects move to help move big leaguers off the roster, like in a Jordan Hicks trade, where David Sandlin is like, we'll send him with you if you'll take Jordan Hicks to the White Sox. Is that, I know that we talked about Toley. I know we talked about early. There are a couple guys who will probably make an impact in 2026. But if you said what this farm system is going to make its biggest impact for the Red Sox, and we've seen this, again, somewhat on the offseason already, is it really now kind of more that there's a lot of players here that could be moved in trades to help the big league club? Is this a farm system that you should be, you know, if you're a minor leaguer, you don't have to rent now. The good news, you don't have to rent now. Housing is paid for by the big league club, but you shouldn't be, basically getting that Red Sox tattoo necessarily on your arm. If there's a chance that you might get moved.
Another way to put it is that there's probably going to be, like, you know, for those teams that still scout in person, there's probably going to be a pretty good amount of heat on the Red Sox through the first half of the season, because they are a team that's proven open to moving from a variety of prospect classes. And, you know, the fact that they use a Justinson Garcia, because they have, you know, five big league outfielders. So they trade Garcia in order to acquire Johan Oviedo, right? Like, no one really saw that coming, but clearly Garcia wasn't, you know, Garcia represented a tradable asset, even though he's a really nice prospect. Someone who, you know, was in, you know, did he land in the top 100, JJ?
Just off the edge of it. But I would expect, like, I mean, if you're saying, like, if you said, could he get rookie of the year votes in the NL? I wouldn't be stunned, because the opportunity is going to be there for him. I would just say right now, with the Pirates, my guess is he'll get another 350 plate appearances this year than he would have if he'd have stayed in Boston.
Which is exactly why they end up trading him, right? Like, they viewed his opportunity as being limited. And as you're playing the options game and thinking about long-term control and where the opportunity to contribute will hit relative to the opportunity to kind of keep him in the organization, you start to run out of rope. And so you also see that to a certain degree with what I think is a very fascinating trade, like a very telling one that the Red Sox executed in dealing Luis Perales, as high ceiling an arm as you can hope to find in the minors, for Jake Bennett with the Nationals, and just kind of like direct prospect swap. Which I think is telling on a couple of points. One of which is, I do think that the Red Sox have been hyper focused this year on what the impact might be of the implementation of the ABS challenge system in the big leagues, and I think that they have they've kind of shifted the dial a little bit away from stuff and more towards command in the strike zone. And so you saw an offseason in which they traded for Sonny Gray, in which they signed Ranger Suarez, in which they traded Luis Perales in exchange for Jake Bennett, because they're targeting guys who work in the strike zone, which is probably also part of the reason why a David Sandlin ends up being a somewhat expendable prospect in the Jordan Hicks deal, because Sandlin is someone who really struggled to execute within the strike zone. You saw it in pretty pronounced fashion once he got to AAA. But the Red Sox were willing to take a guy with, you know, who was going to be entering, Perales was going to be entering into what, his second option year or his third? I think his third. So this was going to be, you know, he was going to be running out of options after 2026. And so they deal him for Jake Bennett, who is, you know, just added to the 40-man roster, but who is, you know, who has 3 years of options of optionality remaining. So you saw that change, and they're willing to deal prospects for prospects, and that pitching prospects for pitching prospects. That tells you a lot about how they're approaching the fluidity of training and of their system and of development. And how, yes, you're right, JJ. I think rent don't own.
This will be his third option this year, which again kind of gets you into that point where all of a sudden you're because we've always been talking with Perales of, okay, well, this is the guy who could maybe start or he ends up in the pen. If you're going to move him to the pen, you kind of want to do that ideally before you run out of, you know, like you kind of want to have some option years. That's kind of the value of a pen guy, is to have a young guy who's got option years and, you know, give you quality innings in the pen. But that's, you know, again, that's where they kind of moved. They've moved it on to another guy who they have a little bit more time before they need to make any decisions like that with.
And the Nationals are a great landing spot for Perales because they're going to have the opportunity, not only if they want to not only to let him develop, you know, for plenty of the year, use a 40-man spot on a guy who's going to spend a lot of the year in the minors, right? Like you can let him have 4 months, 5 months in the AAA rotation, and then maybe give him a look at the end of the year or stash him for the whole thing, you know, whatever. I guess. Yeah, that would you wouldn't be able to delay the service time clock on him, so maybe not, right? Because he's going to have to be in the big leagues by the beginning of 2027. So you probably call him up late in the year, but they will be able to give him runway to develop in the minors on his own schedule, get that big league call up in the rotation at the end of the season, and probably carrying into 27, they can continue to give him that opportunity in the rotation if they think that path is still there. Whereas the Red Sox need someone who's going to be an immediate rotation contributor if they're going to have a spot in the big league rotation.
That leads to the last question I want to ask you, because you mentioned the Nationals. How much does the Nationals obviously hire Paul Toboni, and not just him, but there was a kind of like, obviously whenever that happens, you expect that you're going to see some people leave also to go with and kind of move up and get promotions because they're going to a new regime. How much is there again, a little bit of a brain drain. This is a good problem for an organization to have. It's when you're having, you know, people who are in relatively high roles, but lower roles than where they get, you know, when they get to run their own team. But do you think that you're going to see, like, that the Red Sox will see much of an impact from these kind of moves like this? Or is it something where, well, that's just kind of the price of the normal price of doing business?
I think that the extent of high level hires elsewhere like has to be felt to some degree, right? Like, so it's not just Paul Toboni. You mentioned the Devin Pearson, who had been their director of amateur scouting, is now over with the Nationals as an assistant GM who's going to be in charge of player development. So Jake Brummel, who had been the assistant director of amateur scouting, moves up the ladder. Okay, so you have relative continuity, but still people getting used to the new chair, and without benefit of kind of the institutional wisdom of the previous people who held that job, because both Toboni and Pearson are gone. So Jake Brummel is going to be doing this in many ways. Like, he has a lot to do on. The amount of mentoring that would normally go on for that first year in that position isn't there, right? So there are different people in the Red Sox organization who can provide that kind of feedback, but it's a different dynamic. And you have not only the two of them, but you also have field coordinator and Andrew Wright, who had a huge role in player development. He's now with the Nationals as well. You also have Justin Willard, who'd been the Red Sox director of pitching, basically overseeing their minor league pitching infrastructure. He's gone too. So they promote from within. They promote Ben Buck, who had been a coordinator, coordinator in the upper levels, to be overseeing the whole enchilada. But nonetheless, like, again, you're dealing with different dynamics. I think that one is maybe like that one, that there's more continuity there, right? Because he'll still be able to work with, work with Andrew Bailey at the major league level, work with, you know, Craig Breslow is obviously heavily invested in the pitching development side of things. But yeah, I think that, again, I'm not sure if I would characterize it as, well, you know, there are talented front office people who are no longer there. And so there's a necessary reconfiguration that will occur in the wake of that. But, whether how that manifests itself, whether for good or for bad, that one's going to be tricky to put a finger on for years.
Well, Alex, again, it's always fun to talk baseball with you. I look forward to hopefully running into you in Fort Myers. And if not that, I know we'll run into each other at some point down the road, probably in Philly at the least, when we get to All-Star Week Futures game and the draft and all that running together in a kind of cavalcade of baseball mid-season for them.
We should all enjoy cavalcades. Baseball should come in cavalcades all the time.
But thank you again. And if you did enjoy this, you know, please like and subscribe and tell your friends. We always want to continue to grow the Baseball America podcast, as well as the YouTube channel at Baseball America. And obviously, if you're enjoying this, and you haven't, I can't imagine that you've gotten this far and you haven't gone to baseballamerica.com. But if so, go check out baseballamerica.com. If you got this far in, I promise you, you will enjoy the content at baseballamerica.com. For Alex, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.